Chicago Midway Airport is being privatized. What are the implications? I'm Paul Plack, and this is Aero News. Welcome into this special feature from Aero News. I'm Paul Plack. My guest again today is Bob Poole, who is the Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. We talked in our last time together, Bob, about some of the new technology enabling additional capacity at airports. What I wanted to get into with you on this one was the something that kind of snuck up on me. It wasn't on my radar, and it happened, and Reason Foundation reported on it, and I really haven't heard much said about it elsewhere, and that is the privatization of Midway Airport. Tell us a little bit about the history of this development and how it came down.
Sure. Well, Mayor Richard Daley in Chicago has been very aggressive in looking at the assets that the city owns and trying to figure out, do they really need to continue to be in that business, or could they basically lease them to the private sector under suitable controls and use the lease revenues for improving the city's financial health. And they did that about 3 years ago with the Chicago Skyway, an 8-mile-long toll bridge. They got over $1 billion for it, much to their surprise. They leased the city parking garages. And then they decided, well, hey, Midway Airport is maybe an attractive asset. There's a worldwide move toward airport privatization. The federal Congress passed an airport privatization pilot program more than 10 years ago that's only had little use. Midway would be eligible to be leased long-term to the private sector. Why don't we run that up the flagpole and see if anyone is interested?
You know, at this point, I have to stop and ask you, I know this has been going on for a number of years before it came to fruition.
Yes.
How did this conversation not happen about Meigs Field?
I don't understand that. I mean, that was a tragedy, for all of aviation to see an airport just simply shut down on a whim, on a moment's notice, apparently. And I really have to fault the FAA. I mean, supposedly there's all these grant assurances that protect the federal investment in airports, and they somehow didn't protect Meigs Field.
If I understand correctly, though, there were no remaining outstanding obligations to the federal government at Meigs Field, which was one of the problems.
Well, that must have been the reason that they were able to get away with it.
Because those things have a 20-year lifespan.
They have a 20-year life. That's right. So if they had not gotten any additional grants in the previous 20 years, they were legally free and clear to do that. Unfortunately,
I'm always amazed when people. There was a story not too long ago in the news about a town that's shutting down its airport to create a green space or a park. When I think about that, I think, you know, if you want to guarantee a green space, leave it an airport. An airport is incompatible with any other kind of development.
Yes.
And essentially guarantee
an ongoing tragedy. But anyway, I know we don't have a whole lot of time, so let's get back to Midway.
Yeah. I understand. I've seen toll roads built in other places by private companies. Mm-hmm. But an airport seems, of the size of Midway, seems on a kind of grand scale to do this.
Well, not really, because over the last 15 years, London Heathrow, London Gatwick, Stansted, Sydney, Australia, Frankfurt, Germany, Rome, Melbourne, Australia, Auckland, New Zealand, have all been privatized. Almost all the major Mexican airports except for Mexico City have been privatized. So, I mean, this has been going on. The United States is really kind of the odd man out on this in having none of its airports being run on a professional long-term basis by the private sector. So there is a global airport industry now that all of which is looking very hard at Midway. What the city did, first they had, under the terms of the federal pilot program, they had to negotiate with the airlines and get a supermajority of airlines to agree that the basic outlines of the kind of deal they would offer to the private sector they could live with. And it basically provides 25 years of price protection on landing fees to the airlines. And the airlines have signed off on that and said, okay, that's particularly Southwest, which is the major tenant there. So the next step then the city did in February, they issued a request for qualifications, and that basically lays out the scope of the deal. It says we are interested in well-qualified private firms or teams of firms that would be willing to lease the airport for something like 50 years, although that is apparently negotiable also, and live up to the terms of the deal that we've scoped out with the airlines. and they have until the end of March, the end of this month, to submit their qualification. This is a standard practice, the same thing they did with the toll road.
Right.
So the point of this is to make sure the city doesn't have to evaluate 10 or 15 detailed proposals, and they don't want to make 10 or 15 firms all go through all the agony and the hard work and cost of putting proposals. They're going to look at those qualifications from however many teams submit them and select the three or four what they consider best qualified teams on the merits of their track record and financial capability and experience running airports and so forth. And then they will go back to those three or four and issue them a request for proposals this late spring probably and say, all right, you have until some deadline date to submit your detailed proposal of what you would offer us in terms of lease payments for the airport, what you would do in terms of implementing, what's your financial model, et cetera, et cetera. And then they will select what they consider the best proposal and then take that to the FAA. They already have a preliminary application on file with the FAA for the pilot program. They will submit the proposed deal with the winning bidder and the airline's agreement to it to the FAA, and the FAA will then have to pass final judgment. And assuming that it meets all the terms of the act that Congress passed in 1996, the FAA doesn't really have any choice but to approve it. And so as early as sometime next year, Midway Airport could be leased to the private sector for an amount that nobody really knows. The speculation is up to $3 billion.
Hmm.
I frankly doubt that it will be that high because Midway is so, you know, it's a 1 mile square. It doesn't have much room for growth. It's in very constrained airspace, although NextGen will help with that in the future. But it'll be very interesting to see. This is it looks like all of the major firms, British Airport, BAA, the former British Airports Authority,
right.
Macquarie Airports, that is all over the world, Fraport, which is the company that was formerly the Frankfurt Airport, now privatized and investing in other airports, Hochtief from Germany. So you'll have the cream of the crop looking to get a first mover advantage by being, you know, the first one in the door with a serious privatization of an important airport in the United States.
We're talking today with Bob Poole of the Reason Foundation about the privatization of Midway Airport and what it portends for the future. We'll be back with a couple final questions in a moment. I'm Paul Plack, and you're listening to a special feature from Aero News.
Shoot happens. Come on, you know it does. Even the world's top test pilots know there are in-flight situations you can't always recover from. Mid-air collision, control failure, pilot incapacitation. In severe emergencies, do what the world's top test pilots do. Use a parachute. Except, instead of having to bail out of a moving aircraft, you can have the safety of a BRS full airframe recovery parachute. BRS has parachutes for an enormous variety of aircraft, from experimental to light sport, and all the way to retrofits on certified airplanes. Shoot happens. Will you be ready when it does? Call BRS today at 651-457-8651 or visit us online at brsparachutes.com.
Welcome back to this Aero News special feature. Paul Plack here with Bob Poole, Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation, talking about the privatization of Midway Airport in Chicago and what it might mean for the competitive landscape. And Bob, before we leave Midway and talk in general a little bit about privatization, let me ask you, in the situation of an airport like Midway, where Southwest is a dominant tenant,
right,
is it beyond the realm of possibility to think that an airline might become a bidder to take over an airport? Or does that raise some competitive issues in terms of working with other airlines to continue service that would be uncomfortable?
I don't think the pilot program, it's been a long time since I looked at the pilot program language, but I don't think it explicitly precludes that. I think the FAA would raise some legitimate concerns about that.
Mm-hmm.
Part of what the city will be looking at in deciding which are going to be the bidders invited to bid is track record. And, you know, a Southwest Airlines or whoever doesn't have any track record running airports. So I think they'd be disqualified on those grounds. But it's, you know, that's a very interesting public policy question. I'm an ardent free marketer, but I think I would have some concerns on competitive grounds about one airline having entire control of an airport.
Although in some of the situations that arise within the airline industry, you know, where it's kind of like, all right, you kids work it out for yourselves, there would be some added incentive for that to happen.
Well, there would, no doubt. I mean, it would be a very interesting debate.
Well, let me move on to talk a little bit in general about privatization. It's become kind of a dirty word because obviously it's been vilified as a concept by the general aviation advocacy groups in relation to the user fee debate. And I think there are some perhaps legitimate concerns about how a privatized air traffic control entity you know, might not be everything we would hope it would be. But let's talk about how the FAA stacks up among air traffic control organizations worldwide. The Reason Foundation published an interesting list recently of the top five highly regarded air traffic control organizations in the world. I don't remember what it was termed in terms of effectiveness or
It was based on a survey that was done by Air Traffic Management magazine. They surveyed several hundred experts on aviation and air traffic management in particular, and asked them what is the most highly respected, best run air traffic provider in the world today? And they had an independent firm that has no direct stake in any of this compile all the results. It was the entire content of their issue last fall that was handed out at the Air Traffic Control Association's big annual conference in Washington, which is where I picked it up. And it was fascinating because, you know, everyone in this country, the FAA is number one. It's the best in the world. It's the standard.
Well, I think the quote is typically, we have the biggest and safest aviation system in the world. Why would we want to change it? Unquote.
Right, right. But all implied by that is also that it's the best. That it's the top notch. And the interesting results of this survey was that instead of coming in number one, it came in number three, the FAA, which I think was a shock. I'm sure it was a shock to many dedicated people at the FAA, but it was probably also a shock to those in America's aviation community, whether GA or airline, that heard that news. The number one ranked was NATS, N-A-T-S, the partially privatized air traffic provider in the UK. And the other three in the top five were all commercialized air traffic providers: NAV Canada, Air Services Australia, and DFS, the provider in Germany.
Now, I don't have the list in front of me, but I think NAV Canada came in second.
I believe NAV Canada came in second. Yes, it's been a while since I looked at the list.
Now, when we say highly respected, what factors are going into this determination?
Well, it would include a good value for the money. You know, you get good service for the user fees that you're charged. It would include modernization of you know, making sound investments in upgraded technology and equipment. Would include good customer service, I guess. You know, the customers respect it and speak highly of it.
Mm-hmm.
Those would be the sorts of things: cost effectiveness and modernization and good value for the money.
Okay, what does the FAA need to do to get back in that game? Or, I mean, is it because they're privatized, in your opinion, that they're climbing in rank on that list?
Let me clarify that they're not. Only NAV Canada and NATS are often called privatized, but you have to realize when Phil Boyer of AOPA uses the term as a derogatory term, he means a for-profit monopoly. Okay,
right,
and that's not what any of these are. NAV Canada is essentially a non-profit user co-op with customers occupying the key board seats on the board of directors and making the decisions. NATS, although it does not have general aviation on its board as NAV Canada does, NATS has airline customers on its board of directors, but it's half owned by the British government. So it is it's not an independent private corporation. It is, and it's also run on a not-for-profit basis, which means that in any year that they make a surplus, they reinvest the money in better equipment and facilities, or they reduce the rates in the following year, which NAV Canada has done repeatedly. And the other two, DFS and Air Services Australia, are non-profit government corporations that they're self-supporting from fees and charges, so they're not directly a part of the government budget, but they are part of the government, in the same way that the TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, is a government-owned, federal government-owned corporation,
right,
but that operates just like any other electric utility. It gets its money from the electric bills that it sends to its customers. It issues revenue bonds in the capital markets like any other utility. And so you have to be careful. These are commercialized air traffic providers. They're not really privatized.
All right. Now, in the case of NATS, where there is no GA representation on the board, obviously general aviation is a much smaller deal in the UK than it is in the US. But do pilots who are, you know, recreational or GA pilots in the UK, is their main way to influence the decisions made within the system to bring political pressure through the half that's owned by the government?
I'm sure that's the case. That's really their only alternative because they don't have a direct representation on the board, in contrast to Canada, where the Canadian Business Aircraft Association has a designated board seat, part of the enabling legislation that brought NAV Canada into being. And I have long recommended that in a more complex structure, if we were to commercialize the FAA's air traffic organization, which I do advocate, the board would include, in my preferred model, 3 general aviation seats, 4 airline seats, 1 airport seat, 1 employee seat, and several representing the general public. So you'd have a broad range of customers calling the shots, basically, and making the decisions on equipage and on the timetable for next-gen implementation and so forth.
And what is the rough apportionment of board seats in NAV Canada?
NAV Canada, I think it's three airline, 1 business aviation, 2 for employees because the unions are pretty strong there.
Right.
I think the government has a couple of seats also. It's a smaller board than what I'm proposing for the United States because our system with such a large GA population is more complicated than Canada's.
Okay, so in the case of Canada, general aviation, the airline has more votes, 3 times as many votes as business aviation, but it cannot in any
It can't
in
dominate
any case,
the board because it only has 3 votes out of, I think, 12.
Right,
board.
Right. So it can't have a majority.
No.
Okay. Well, Bob, listen, we always appreciate taking a look at these topics from the point of view of the Reason Foundation, or at least I do. I hope our listeners do, and I hope they'll respond if they don't or do, because it's a side of things we don't often get. And thanks again for taking some time out of the day to spend with our listeners.
Very glad to do it, Paul.
My guest has been Robert Poole, Director of Transportation Studies for the Reason Foundation. You can find out more about them and subscribe to Bob's newsletters at www.reason.org. And you've been listening to a special feature from Aero News. On the web, you can find us at www.aero.net. I'm Paul Platt. Thanks for listening. Have a clear and unlimited day.